In addition to being one of the most gifted and knowledgeable practitioners and educators in the homeopathic community, Richard really is a pioneer for homeopathy. I think he's almost more than anybody that I know of has really committed and devoted his life to advocating and growing homeopathy around the world. And 2 years ago, actually, he won the Henry Williams Award for service in homeopathy, and I really can't think of too many people who deserved it more. So this is somebody who, in addition to being a master homeopathic practitioner and educator, is someone who has contributed greatly to all of our lives, and I'd just like to acknowledge you for that, Richard, and thank you again for joining us.
All right, Kim, you're so gracious. Thank you.
And also, for those people who don't know, Richard was instrumental in basically creating and overseeing the Pacific Academy of Homeopathic Medicine, and recently has made the decision to step down as the director of that school. Richard, I assume you'll still be associated with the school in some capacity, or?
Yeah, haven't yet figured out in what form, but yeah, no doubt I will be in some way.
Yeah, well, of course it'll be a great loss to that school, but I'm sure you'll continue your efforts for homeopathy in other areas, so I'm sure that you'll be able to contribute in other ways.
Great.
So, Richard, you know, I know that homeopathy is going through a lot of changes right now, and you're pretty much in the midst of many different things that are going on in the community. You know, you publish your own journal, you're publishing books now, you're a teacher all around the world. I know you're going to be going to teach in Japan. I guess with your overview of what's going on in the community, I'm curious what you see as some of the biggest obstacles that homeopathy faces today.
I think, to me, the biggest real obstacle in the United States and perhaps Canada as well immediately is just is a legal one. It's an interesting perspective because one could state that if it all starts from energy, and homeopathy is an energy medicine, and that the vital force is strong in the profession, it will permeate into a healthy culture and a healthy environment for the practice and well-being of the profession, including our ability to sustain a decent living doing homeopathy, and for homeopathy to be well understood amongst the populace and for it to take its rightful place in the community as a very profound and, you know, form of medical care. But I'm not actually convinced that that's the case, and that in spite of what I see as some very positive innovations in homeopathy from a point of view of our own knowledge base, that is our knowledge of medicines, our ability to prescribe remedies, looking into new remedies, the evolution of proving methodology again, which I think is a very positive sign in the profession. I mean, in some ways, there's a healthy intellectual environment, if somewhat combative at times, but it's healthy. But I actually think that in some ways we should not be naive about the challenges we face from a legal political point of view in terms of the possible acceptance of homeopathy as a viable form of medical practice or medical art, or call it what you like, when we exist in an environment which is very punitive against alternative therapies. And homeopathy, I think more than any other profession, exists in a legal limbo. No other medical profession has had the same history that homeopathy has had in terms of competing, vying, and combating what we saw as the conventional medical protocol, and has not really in any way evolved beyond that. We are still sort of stuck, I think, in a miasm of a somewhat defensive reactionary position against the omnipotence of allopathic dominion, and we haven't really forged our own identity, and we are now split, if you want, and have always been so, between those who practice it under medical licensure and those who practice it under common law or under health freedom regulation or legislation. And in a sense, our identity as a unique profession is still somewhat divided, and we need to grapple with that. And I think it profoundly inhibits the success of our schools and of practitioners coming out and actually being able to make a decent living doing it. This is a big issue.
Richard, recently there have been some very strong attacks in Great Britain against the homeopathic community. Do you have any comments about what's been going on there? Because many people may not be aware of what's been going on in England at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not deeply familiar with it. There are other people, I know you'll interview Carol Boyce at some point on this matter, who's more intimately connected with the situation, but it is important for us to be aware of what is happening. even if the situation is different in England. Remember, England in 1946, I think it was, when they created the National Health Service, which is state-funded medicine, homeopathy was included within that form of practice. So you could become a medical doctor, specialize in homeopathy at the Faculty of Homeopaths, and then you could practice under the National Health Service. And that has been the case until this day, that certain amounts of funding of the National Health Service have gone toward homeopathy. And the sort of the figurehead operation has been in London at the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital, which is this extraordinary building in the center of London. Slowly that building is being encroached on and has been taken over by other hospital institutions surrounding it, and to the point now where they're wanting to totally take over the homeopathic hospital. And in England, there are different boroughs, you know, within like a county that are in charge of determining where the medical funding goes to. And there's been a concerted campaign to eliminate the access to homeopathy within medical practice, that's within the medical status quo, of many of these boroughs. And a hospital in Tunbridge Wells is being forced to close, and they're trying to keep it open. But homeopathy has taken an extremely defensive position as a result of that. And unfortunately, the profession has not fought back in any way, shape, or form enough to really combat this attack. And this attack is not just coming from an economic point of view. It's politicized to the highest level of the medical profession. And even there was a chair of Exeter University, and this is a sponsored chair in alternative and complementary medicine. And this man, who was an advocate for homeopathy, suddenly turned and basically became a big critique of homeopathy. And we wonder why that was and what was going on there. And so, not to mention the report in The Lancet, this meta-analysis of the efficacy of homeopathy, in which the conclusion was that there's no statistical evidence and scientific evidence to substantiate homeopathy's effect in any way, shape, or form. And the editorial stated, well, this basically is the death knell of homeopathy, because finally, you know, we have proven what we all know to be true, which is homeopathy is a farce and it shouldn't exist. This has been the campaign coming on many, many levels. And So although it was mainly focused on those physicians who were doing homeopathy as part of the National Health Service, the rest of the profession, that is the profession I belong to and the Society of Homeopaths, the organization I belong to, are not doing that well. The society has not rallied to the cause. There has been very little concerted attempts to basically protect homeopathy. And many practitioners in England, in which we already have common law to practice, struggle to make a living. There is a struggle for us to be able to sustain ourselves. And if that's the bottom line and we can't make a living doing homeopathy, then the viability of the profession is going to be really compromised. Yeah. And because of the greater standardization and globalization of many things, including the Codex Alimentarius, which is the whole standardization of access to healthcare, really, you're talking about everything from supplements to products, we should be careful that the same attacks that have happened in England have been and will be used here to basically challenge homeopathy. And you can bet your bottom dollar that when homeopathy, or if homeopathy becomes more popular and more accessible or successful and there's more money being made, the attacks will come, you know. And we need to be ready as a profession for this, you know, because, you know, otherwise we will be in bad shape.
Mm. So, Richard, in that context, are there things that you think that we can do here to make homeopathy stronger?
There's a lot, and a lot is already being done. I think in many ways I see good and bad at the same time. I mean, the good things are that the standard of homeopathic education has improved in the last 10 years. The schools that have been functioning for 10 years or more have been doing well in what they are teaching. I think generally it's been good. We've all improved and we've all done good work. And there are now, 10 or 15 schools that you could say in the United States that have got 3 or 4 year programs that at the end of it, you know, can feel happy that people have got a reasonable education. This is crucial for the profession. The future of the profession is bringing new people into it who will take on the mantle of practice and will be able to implement all of our work and philosophy and actually give people good care. This is the key. But unfortunately, this has not been fully recognized and fully appreciated within the profession at large. And I've you know, critique this amongst different organizations, even amongst the National Center for Homeopathy and organizations, saying you need to acknowledge and recognize the absolute significance of homeopathic education, because this is what's going to make the profession survive. So on one level, I see that that is needs to be developed further. On that front, I mean, there, I suppose the most sort of interesting and potentially important thing is the efforts in Arizona to produce a full-time homeopathic medical school using the existing statute of the homeopathic board that exists in Arizona. And this could be very interesting if they can really get this off the ground and you would have a real homeopathic medical school. And we can debate the details of content of teaching and methodologies and curriculum and stuff, but the fact of developing a full-time medical school could be a really interesting innovation. So one level is education. And I actually, you know, feel like, yes, it wouldn't it be great to have a four-year full-time homeopathic program, you know, similar to what the osteopaths have. You know, similar to what the acupunctural chiropractors have or naturopaths. We need a four-year program like the naturopaths have, but instead of just doing all the naturopathic stuff, we would be homeopathic specialists. We would do homeopathy. This is the way to go. But to do this, you have to change the legal climate. You're forced to look at the issue of whether licensure is one model that you have to apply, because otherwise you're never going to get a full-time homeopathic program going. And I think for full acceptance of homeopathy as a viable profession on an equal footing with other ones, you know, we're going to have to grapple with that sooner or later. Secondly, I think, or thirdly, the other area is really creating health freedom legislation in all the states. That is a first step. We have it in California, but I still think we're faced with the next step now. But I think that is another crucial thing. And I think in every state, you should have active state associations that really work in each state, because every state is different, has a different legality, different political, cultural climate. We need active people to form state associations or state medical associations or whatever in order to really work on that level and really kind of help preserve it from the ground up. So,
Richard, you mentioned the project that Todd Rowe is working on, the homeopathic full-time homeopathic medical college.
Yeah.
And I was just curious, what is the response from the rest of the homeopathic community relative to that project? I mean, are the schools supporting it? Do you know? And how about the naturopathic colleges? What is their?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know what the gig is in Arizona. I'm sure that Todd has been addressing this quite actively, because you do have a naturopathic school in Arizona. You know, so I actually don't know the answer to that. I think is interesting.
And the other schools, do you know about them? I mean, like, are they pretty much supportive of this?
I think everyone basically is. You know, I think, you know, everyone's basically supportive of the idea that this would be a good thing. We need good homeopathic education. If they can get this off the ground, it could be a very interesting process. I mean, I'm sure some people have some gained questions maybe about some aspects of content of the structure of the program and all that. But I mean, I think in principle, I think there's a lot to be looking at it in a really interesting light to see where this is going to go. You know.
And Richard, if they do establish this institution, what impact do you think it'll have on the other schools? I mean, would these other schools still exist, and would they? I mean, how do you see that playing out?
That's really interesting. I mean, Arizona is just around the corner, sort of figuratively speaking, from California.
Right.
But you see, in a way, it may attract people to go to those schools who really want to become a homeopathic physician. But it is only going to allow them to work in Arizona.
That's the thing.
I mean, so if you're living in California, you don't want to live in Arizona. I think all the other schools will function just fine, you know. And I think it will attract perhaps different people to it. And I think it will attract younger people, because one of the critiques we have of each other is that homeopathies, you know, attract people who use it as somewhat of a pastime or as a, you know, a half-time profession. The amount of people who are earning a living, doing it full-time, raising a family on it, or whatever it takes to basically, you know, live wherever you are and earning a living, are not that many. And unfortunately, still in our profession, a lot of people who come to our schools are men and predominantly women who are, you know, in their maybe their 40s, you know, who have gone through family or career and have been philosophically or practically turned onto homeopathy and are looking at it as an alternative career. But it's not attracting people in their 20s, very early 30s so much who say, this is it. and are willing to give it that. Now, if you have this full-time medical program, it probably will attract younger people.
Right.
I go to teach at the acupuncture school in San Francisco, and, you know, I go and do my hour and a half spiel on homeopathy, and I see it's full of people who the main reason they're going to that school is not necessarily because they're committed to acupuncture and they think it's the most fantastic thing. It's because they get a license at the end of it, and they come out and they think, rightly or wrongly, that they're going to basically sustain themselves and make a living doing it. And that's the reason they go. And most of us are drawn to homeopathy for idealistic reasons, which I think is great. We should be. But at the same time, I don't think a massive number are going there thinking, well, I can really go in with confidence that after 3, 4 years or 5 years, I'm going to be able to make a decent living doing it.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like, this is not easy.
Right.
It's not easy in this culture.
Right.
Especially in America, where everything is kind of defined by its legality and defined by its standing in society, and homeopathy literally does not have that. And it's, even in the Bay Area, it's tough.
Yeah. You know, Richard, a friend of mine, I was visiting with somebody recently, and they told me they were at a conference in England where the instructor asked everybody to stand up, and then he said, you know, he gave, like, in $10,000 increments the amount of money that they were making in their homeopathic practice, and at each $10,000 increment, they had to sit down. And when he hit $60,000, there were only two people standing in that room of 100 people, which means that only two out of the 100 people made more than $60,000 a year. And when he told me that, I was really surprised that, you know, that it was that low a percentage. And I think this is getting back to what you were saying about the difficulty of making a living. Can you talk a little bit more about that, just the economic factors in relationship to homeopathy? Because I think that, you know, certainly with the economic situation as it currently exists in North America right now, with the subprime woes and everything else, that people are having some financial difficulties. And I'm curious if you could comment a little bit about that and its relationship to homeopathy.
You were relating statistics in England, yeah?
Yeah, this was something that somebody, this was Mamasa actually told me the story from a conference in England about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago.
One point to kind of differentiate between England and America. In America, people are used to paying for their health care via insurance or third-party payer or whatever. In England, you are not. The culture is it's free. There's a level of resentment about paying for it. People are less willing to pay for it. Secondly, therefore, people charge less. They cannot charge so much. An average intake for a first-time intake for someone who's even fairly experienced could be £50-60, which, again, depending on the dollar, it could be like $90, $100, you know, and that's it. And follow-ups are, you know, maybe $30, $40, you know. So generally, especially if you're outside London, London may be unique in charging more, but most people cannot make that money just because they cannot charge that, because people will not go. Here, people are willing and able to spend more going to see a homeopath. So that's one factor. Secondly, the way we work is that we see people infrequently. To build up enough of a practice to have enough income to see enough people takes quite a long time, because if you're working, you know, 3, 4, say 4 days a week, and you have, you know, 10 people a day, you know, that's 40 a week, 160 a month. I mean, it takes a lot of time to build up a clientele, really, that because we don't see people frequently. Most other alternative professions, acupuncturists, chiropractors especially, you know, see people more frequently, whether they need it or not. I mean, and that's one of our critiques of these professions, is that they are taught about marketing and they are taught to bring people back in, even when we know it's really not that crucial and it's more of an economic issue. It seems built into the homeopathic protocol, as we know, is that we need time. You give a remedy, you need time to wait. So there is an uphill struggle for us to develop enough clientele to be able to make a decent living. How much we charge is the second part of that. I mean, and people charge hugely varying amounts depending on where they live and their own personal thing. One of my critiques of homeopathy is that sometimes we charge not enough and sometimes we charge too much. When you're charging sort of $400, $500, $600, $700 for initial intake, it becomes homeopathy like it did in the 19th century to some extent. You know, the privilege of elite upper middle class people. And on the other hand, if you charge too little, then it's very difficult to make a living. So finding the specific economic sort of niche that works, that you can make a decent living without charging a huge amount and be busy, you know, that's the challenge. And I think the possibility is there in America because people are used to paying for healthcare, first of all, but they're not willing to pay too much up front. And I think on the other hand, people will come when they know about it. And at the moment, they really just don't know about it. So they're not going to put out the money, you know?
Richard, I know that over the last 20 years or so, you've been involved in almost every organization in North America that's somehow associated with homeopathy. And I'm just curious if you could, you know, in all these years of experience working with these different organizations, if you can kind of give us an overview of the different institutions or entities or organizations that support people who are trying to develop a homeopathic profession.
Yeah. I mean, if we are going to call ourselves a profession, and this, I will kind of preempt this with a kind of a little philosophical kind of a side, but if we want to call ourselves a profession, as in a collective identity with a particular name relating to a particular protocol or methodology and system, basically we need certain organizations in place that create the infrastructure, the accountability, and all the other aspects of what really defines a profession. So we need those organizations. Unfortunately, the profession in general has been somewhat ambivalent to this need. And it's very interesting why this is. And one reason is that homeopathy is the profession of the individualization of each case, of each person, of each disease process, and for that matter, of each homeopath. As we embrace the subjective aspect of the human condition, you know, homeopathy is as much art form as science, as we know, you know, and that's its beauty as well as its complexity. But that's the gig. As such, homeopathy basically has focused so much on the individual is that we kind of sometimes lose the perspective of what we really, really share. And I'm not making a dramatic point, because in some ways we are extraordinarily integrated in some ways as a profession, but there's so much sort of focus on the individual that sometimes I think we get so sort of focused on our own process, our own situation, the right remedy, that it actually becomes somewhat of a narcissistic process. And as such, we can sometimes lose the thread of what really connects us as a profession. And therefore, what really does connect us is the idea that we can come to a consensus of a basic methodology within all the variations of individual protocol, but something that we really can share. And I think we need to kind of keep our heads up there. And I think sometimes we get so focused on the remedy, the individual, this situation, that we actually lose perspective of what we are all doing together. So in order to basically find what we all share, you need certain standards, and to have standards you need somebody to implement them, and then you need people to agree to that. You need the profession to acknowledge that and support it. And so there are various organizations that fulfill a certain unique role. First of all, you have the schools. The schools set the basic consensus of a curriculum and standard, and within that there's some variety. But within the classical methodology, which is what we're talking about, I'm not talking about really much else beyond that, that exists outside of that, of which there's actually a huge amount, really, of activity that still carries the term homeopathy. But really, you know, it's like it's chalk and cheese to us. It's totally different. But within classical methodology, you've got schools. Then after that, you've got organizations like the Council for Homeopathic Certification, which I've been on the board of that organization for 18 years, since 1991 when we began the organization. This council certifies individual practitioners to evaluate a basic level of homeopathic competency in classical homeopathy. So this is equivalent to a licensing board, except we don't have any of those privileges or legality. It is a peer review process, but at least it sets a common standard, and at least it's something that the profession can acknowledge and recognize, and the public can use as a means to evaluate competency. A very interesting thing happened with when the NCH, to their great credit, 2 years ago in their directory of practitioners, chose to, instead of just listing their medical licensure first of all after their name, and people could voluntarily choose to say that they are a professional homeopath and they would be put in bold in the directory. They didn't go through any process to do so. They would just said, oh yes, I'm a professional homeopath. But who knew what training they had? Who knew what experience they had? I mean, this was just a purely voluntary process. So the NCH, again, as I say, to their credit, stated, well, let's put after their names, first of all, what homeopathic credential they have, not just the CHC, but any, you know, recognized credential coming from not a school, but an objective, independent organization that has formally evaluated competency. And this was a great thing because at least now the public, not to mention the profession, is recognizing the standards that have existed and that have continued to exist for quite a while now. After doing that, quite a number of people no longer renewed their subscription to homeopathy to the NCH or to be listed. Therefore, the only reason they were joining that organization and being listed, it seemed, was so that they could state they were a professional homeopath. And the people who chose not to seemingly were people who were not accredited by any organization. Mm. So it shows you how much they really supported homeopathy if that was their only reason, you know? So this is exactly my point. These people need to be accredited, but they need to be acknowledged, and that needs to happen through an objective process. So I have to say, obviously, this has been what I have probably sweated more blood over than any other organization. We need a decent examination evaluation process that is a common standard for everybody. And in that, there is all the room in the world for individual approaches and people's specializations or people if they want to learn with one practitioner or another practitioner, fine, they can do what they like. But there is something that has been acknowledged and recognized within the profession that this at least represents the standard. And do you know how long it's taken us for the profession to really begin to recognize this? It's 18 years. I mean, and when you're on the other side and you're trying to do the work and set and do this stuff, it's kind of sometimes, you know, it's frustrating. It's hard work, you know. And we're all doing it volunteer. A lot of people have been volunteering, you know, however many hours a week for years doing this. And it's a challenge. But anyway, this is one organization. Another one is the Council for Homeopathic Education. And this organization struggled really to get off the ground ever since its inception 20 years ago. And this accredits schools. This, in theory, is an organization that if it accredited all the major schools in homeopathy, and this has been debated, and there's still no consensus about whether this should go in this direction. But in theory, what it could do is that it could ask for federal recognition of its standard accreditation process. That would then allow all schools accredited by it to get federal funding, to get loans. You know, then the school could actually attract more people, ideally, because they would be accredited and recognized. Some people say, well, why do we want to do that? Do we want to be regulated by the state in any way? We need to keep our profession as an independent profession. Maybe we do as well. I'm not fixed on it, but I think we still need to recognize that we exist in a social structure, and as such, we need to conform to certain protocols if we want to be accepted as a profession. That's another part of the profession that needs to be in place for our educational evolution. Then, I mean, obviously the NCH, I mean, is a vital organization in terms of being the liaison between the public domain and the political domain within the public and the homeopathic profession. And it needs to protect the interests of the homeopathic profession in that way to ensure that we are really being protected and we are working, our profession is being really supported. And their membership is dwindling. I mean, consistently over the number of years, it has dwindled. Not to mention that the conference, the conference which has become now a conference of different organizations altogether, and that's happened because people were not going to the conferences any longer. So there is really a kind of interesting situation. We have more homeopaths out there doing homeopathy, apparently, and we have less people going to the conferences, less people coming together. And it could be to do with the conference itself and that we've lost our something that we used to have there or not. I don't know. But there seems to be an unwillingness for everyone to come together in that way. But that's another organization that really needs to thrive and it needs to be strengthened. Otherwise, you know, we will be vulnerable. So,
Richard, you mentioned earlier the word consensus, and you were talking about the CHC and some type of standardization for testing. And I just wanted to ask you, because I know that there's been quite a bit of shift in the homeopathic community over the last few years, especially in the direction of the work of Rajan Sankaran. And I know that, for example, a number of schools have either decided to teach his methodology almost exclusively or to make it a significant portion of the curriculum of those various institutions. And so you know, my question really is, if there's this movement among many schools, and even now Rajan Sankaran, because in the past Sankaran would always maintain that you had to have a good foundation in classical homeopathy, and then this was just basically additional tools that you could use to help find a remedy in a particular case. But I know more recently he came out and actually reverted that statement and came out and said that he felt that actually you don't even need to have a foundation in classical homeopathy. So could you comment on that whole situation? Because there seems to be this very strong movement in the community towards the adoption of Sankaran's methodology, and yet that I don't think we could define that as classical homeopathy. So how do you see that whole thing playing out over the next few years? Or do you have any comments on it at all? It's a conundrum for me, because I don't know how, where is this whole thing going to go? I mean, you know.
Yeah. We have a conference every year. It's called NANHE, N-A-N-H-E, the North American Network of Homeopathic Educators. And this actually is an annual conference that we have actually in the Bay Area last few years, and it's an offshoot of the CHE, even though we've now kind of separated its function somewhat. And also was sponsored originally by the Homeopathic Community Council, which was an old organization, which was just a collective of homeopathic organizations, individuals. That's now more under the auspices of the homeopathic, well, I'm getting my acronyms mixed up now, the HAA, I think. And anyway, so we have talked about this in the NANHE conference, about styles, methodologies, individual practitioners or teachers sort of styles, and even though some people there at the conference very much are into the approach, particularly of Sankaran, you know, there's always been a consensus that basically all the schools need to teach the fundamentals of homeopathy that have always been tried and true, and that represent the foundational thinking of our practice. Now, within that, there are, I think, different people will apply, you know, Sankaran's methodology, and some people do it rather exclusively, they say. And I don't know, though, to be honest, though, Kim, how many schools really apply that style of methodology as basically the foundational course of their program. I honestly don't think they do, as far as I know.
There's more and more all the time who are making it a larger part of the curriculum, I think.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, yeah. I haven't seen that. I have to say, I mean, I haven't seen it within the NANHE community. You know, even though I know quite a few people there, you know, or some of the people there would say that they apply that methodology quite a lot. The gig is this, as far as the CHC is concerned. The CHC basically is interested in not representing any one particular position or style or methodology or particular philosophy within homeopathy. It's staying very much within the foundational thinking of the tradition, if you want. You know, it's really not that complex. You know, the CHC exam basically has a repertory test. You know, you just got to prove that you know the repertory. You know. And materia medica, you just got to prove you know some remedies well enough so that you can speak about them off the top of your head or write about them, you know. It's like anybody who's in practice will know materia medica. It's not memorization. It's just by default knowledge that you have, you know, and it shows some knowledge. And then there is a, you know, philosophy thing, which is very much geared and related to the basic philosophical text of the Organon and in Kent's philosophy and those fundamental books. So the exam is basically not even attempting to kind of embrace that. Now, where this could come up would be when people do the first examination part of the CHC exam, and that's successfully completed, they then submit 5 cases for the second part, which represents their own thinking, their own process, their own methodology. And they have to write an analysis after they've taken the case and justified the remedy about why they chose what they chose and what that was all about. And we lay out the protocol of what we expect people to do. Now, if someone sends in cases, for example, that shows Sankaran's thinking, to be honest, that's fine if they make a clear analysis of the argument for the remedy. It makes sense. The remedies work. They can evaluate the follow-up, and it conforms to that protocol. I don't think there is that much difference in the end. The only difference mainly is the way you're going to get there. You know, now, there's a lot of debate that, you know, if you want to critique it, that basically doing it this way, you're going to come up with some anecdotal image of a remedy, and you're going to give a remedy by some loose concept of the doctrine of signatures based on hand movement. I think there's enough critique even within the people who do that method that that's not what it's really meant to be about. And unfortunately, that's perhaps the abuse of it by people who don't understand it or don't even understand homeopathy. And I think it's a valid criticism that if people are applying that method without really knowing much homeopathy, they're going to get lost, you know? And so,
I just wanted to interrupt you. You seem to be fading in and out. I don't know if you're moving closer or further away from me.
I don't know. I don't know either.
Okay.
So,
wait. Just I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay. Yeah. So they. I think that there's easy that you could get lost, but I think that homeopathy you can get lost at the best of times. You know, so I mean, and you know, and I teach a lot of students, and I see, you know, I see people coming up with all kinds of stuff, you know, and so, you know, or based on sort of theoretical abstractions up the gazoo, and whether you're using the so-called Sankaran method or not, I mean, that's one of the worst sort of problems that we face as practitioners is to ground people. And personally, I just say, you know, we are a science. As a science, you need to be able to analyze. And if you analyze, you have to be able to replicate your thinking. Even if I'm very much middle of the road. I say, I don't care how you get to the remedy. If you can stand on your head, you know, chanting a mantra, and that gets you to the remedy, all well and good. But you still got to be able to, after the fact, justify what's happened and why it's happened. You still got to be able to rationalize your explanation. I'm not just say, well, I felt it was sulfur because I just thought, well, I felt it. I mean, that's no good in anyone's thinking. So, again, it's more about your ability to analyze and convince, you know, the person, the other person in this case, say in this THC process, that you understand what you're doing, you know. Personally, I think there's something to the Sankara method, but to say it's a whole system that basically superimposes itself over everything else, I don't particularly think that's the case. But that's just my opinion. The CHC doesn't even take an opinion on it. We just want cases to be well taken, well thought out, well analyzed, and well justified.
Sure.
And that's it, you know? Because if you start taking a position about any of this, you know, then I think, you know, it's bad for the profession. It's bad for our organization.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm interested in personally as I watch the profession evolve and change, I say, well, let's give it some time.
Right.
Let's see what comes about. And the question is, how honest are we? How
right.
really honest are we as practitioners and that we can really stand behind our results or not? How honest are we in admitting our failures? I don't care what method you choose. We're going to have successes and failures. Sometimes I've seen amazing cases with the so-called Sankara method, you know, and other times, you know, well, I'm not so sure, you know, and it's the same in all of our cases. And I think, you know, we need to be open to learning more. And if this helps people, great. I mean, good. But my main feeling philosophically is that when you adopt a new method, there's always the temptation to make it the next thing, to kind of like become, to kind of make it an ism of an ism, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we're already an ism, homeopathy. We're already what I call a cult, you know? Because a religion is a cult that's got power. We're a cult with no power, so we're not a religion. So, and I think there's been too much cultification in homeopathy. And I go back even to Hahnemann. I think we carry the miasm of Hahnemann. This is my personal opinion, and I'm not speaking about anything else. I'm just saying, and I feel like, we, of course, pay homage to the man, but, you know, not everything he said was necessarily right or true. Let's be adult about this, and let's just question, critique, and let's evolve and grow. And, you know, and I think we need to also grow into our own power individually and stop projecting that onto other teachers as well, you know. Teachers play a certain role in homeopathy, but, you know, we still have this desire for them to kind of lead us on the path, you know. We're still looking for Moses, you know, and I think we need to basically be true to ourselves, you know. So, and that will grow the profession. Then the profession will not be just the conglomeration of individuals or great teachers or masters, that word we use for our tradition, these great homeopaths of the past. We can be the masters. We can be the new generation, you know? But we can all be in it together.
Mm.
I want the Swedish socialism view of homeopathy, you know? You know?
Hey, Richard, I know that, you know, one of the things that as the homeopaths that we deal with is that we have different categories of practitioners. We know we've got people who are just lay practitioners. We've got people who are medical doctors. We've got naturopathic doctors. So how do you see the relationship between homeopathy and these other professions in which homeopathy is practiced?
Okay, now you're going to really get me going here. And this is an interesting thing. We have and had always a really active a community amongst the naturopathic community who are homeopaths. And some great homeopaths have been naturopaths and who really are homeopaths. I mean, they use their naturopathic licensure, but the heart is homeopathy. That, I mean, and that's been the case. And that the organization is the HAMP, which has, you know, been around for a number of years and had the similar moment. They've done phenomenal work. But they are also struggling to attract new members of their profession to become homeopaths and to take the HAMP exam, which in fact is allied to the CHC exam. They take the CHC exam, and we have a professional relationship between the HAMP and the CHC so that we have the same standard. And this has been a fantastic relationship, and it's worked really well. Now, most naturopaths who go to naturopathic school only do 80 hours of homeopathy. And that is done under duress. They don't like it. They don't want to know it. And they do it just because they got to. They don't think homeopathically. They don't feel homeopathically. They're not homeopaths. And if they use homeopathy, it's merely as an adjunct. The proportion of people who become homeopaths and embrace homeopathy to the degree to which you have to practice it well is minimal. I don't even know a statistic. 1 in 100, say, is very, very few. And there's a great struggle for homeopathy to get more traction within the naturopathic community. The school's old curriculum is already so imbalanced, meaning that in a four-year program, they do 2 years of meds, and then they do 2 years in everything else. And of that, 1/20th or 1/50th of that is homeopathy. So they come out after 4 years being, they become a smorgasbord approach to homeopathy or to natural healing. They know a little bit about a lot and not a lot about anything. And I think, to be honest, it's not a great model for an education, and it's a lousy model for homeopathy. And I think we should not be deluded that homeopathy is going to really grow and prosper within the naturopathic community. But at the same time, obviously it has to be there, and we want to work hard to make sure that there are some great naturopaths there who come out and are really going to take homeopathy on and embrace it and go for it. And perhaps it will grow. So far, it hasn't happened. Secondly, legally, and this is, you know, an interesting topic, my personal opinion is that one of the challenges we face in homeopathy is that as naturopathy is licensed in more states, and homeopathy is part of the scope of practice of those licensures, this could have a very negative impact on the ability for homeopaths to practice legally. Because at the moment, there are no other professions in which homeopathy is specifically listed in the scope of practice. You could say by default it's a practice of medicine, so it's under the domain of doctors. That's the default analysis based on existing medical statute in most states. Because everything is medicine. In most statutes, healing and medicine are the same and therefore are under the dominion of a doctor. It's simple as that. It's a monopolistic statute. If you have professions like naturopathy that include homeopathy in their scope of practice, and the type of bill that passes in each state is a scope of practice bill, that scope of practice, it gives exclusive mandate to those modalities within that profession. And that could include homeopathy. So it could be interpreted that homeopathy is the exclusive domain of naturopathic medicine. Mm. That happens, and it still remains marginalized within naturopathic programs. Homeopathy would merely be an adjunct minor therapy as a function of naturopathic medicine. Mm. And we will be permanently inferiorized, if that's a word, I've never used it before, but we'll be put in an inferior position, not just to allopathic medicine historically, which we already were, we will repeat that with naturopathy. And the profession hasn't grasped that because we have so many brethren within our community who are naturopaths, one, you know, and two, there isn't really the view to understand the legal implications of what's going on. Luckily, in California, we passed the Health Freedom Bill before the naturopath passed their naturopathic bill, and therefore their bill accommodated our right to practice alternative and complementary medicine, including homeopathy, freely under a basic common law mandate, which basically stated that if something's fundamentally not dangerous, it shouldn't be regulated by the state in that particular way. If you're not pretending, you're not performing as a physician, you don't need to be regulated as one. And so we clearly delineated the roles that we perform as professional homeopaths. So I have real concerns that as naturopathy is growing, and I feel like there is a movement within the political movement of naturopathic medicine, and this is not our brethren, our friends, our naturopathic homeopath friends, but within the political movement to make naturopathy the definitive alternative complementary medicine outside of acupuncture and other existing cares, and that they will then carve out a niche which will create an exclusive mandate of practice which will subsume homeopathy as part of naturopathy. This is a big problem.
Interesting.
In medical training, there are medical schools that are beginning to implement homeopathy, but it's really piecemeal. There's no school that in any way even touches on training someone as a homeopath. So within the medical profession, homeopathy is dying on a vine. The AIH, which is the American Institute of Homeopathy, the oldest homeopathic organization in the United States, and its affiliate organization, the ABHT, the American Board of Homeotherapeutics, which is their accreditation board, similar to the CHC, but for medically licensed people, they are not growing in membership. They have not grown in membership, if I could be wrong, but within more than 10 people in 10 years. So if you look at organizationally wise, HAMP has barely grown. The ABHT has barely grown. The CHC has grown slowly but surely, you know. But by God, this is a long, hard slog, you know. And I don't have a lot of comfort or confidence that homeopathy's growth inside other medical professions, which is mainly naturopathy and medical profession, is at all healthy. It's not, and it's not growing, you know.
Richard, I'd like to give other people an opportunity to ask you some questions, so I'm going to just ask you one more question and then switch it over. You know, you've covered a lot of information this evening, and maybe you could sum it up by kind of giving us a sense of what the legal options are for homeopathy in the future and what we can do to, you know, move our profession forward.
Yeah, this, my opinion, health freedom laws in every state. First and foremost, get the mandate in every state. That's the bottom line, which is the freedom of access and of all professions. And every profession, therefore, after that needs to choose what level of regulation it would like to have with the state. But first and foremost is health freedom. Working with the National Health Freedom Coalition and people like Diane Miller in Minnesota and other states from the national point of view and the state point of view is crucial. You know, this is that state associations in each state which help educate people in homeopathy and really help the public domain. Remember, homeopathy was saved in America and in England and Europe by so-called lay practitioners and housewives and people doing it and having access to it. The most important thing, maintaining access to homeopathic remedies, making sure that the Codex Alimentarius and other draconian sort of trans-global kind of dynamics within our society do not create exclusive dominion over the access to homeopathic remedies, not to mention other alternative products. This needs to be maintained in the public domain. We have to protect the rights of people to have access to that. After that, I think we need to decide, and this will be done on a state-by-state level as much as it would be within the profession, whether we want to grapple with other forms of regulation, of which there are basically three: certification, registration, and a licensure. Certification and registration are fairly similar. They require some kind of regulation by the state, even if it's just a tacit one. That is a basic kind of giving a name, paying a fee, Bob's your uncle, you're out doing it. That's a, you know, without any other regulation or assessment of standards. That's the basic one. And there was a big debate in New York 2 years ago when they tried to pass a kind of health freedom kind of bill which required a regulation of registration. And a lot of the profession were against it, and they divided the profession, and it divided the people going for that that bill, and therefore it didn't pass. Because people did not feel that they wanted to be registered in any way with the state. We felt we did not want the permission of the state in order to determine our right to do what we should feel we could do freely. This was a big debate, and there was a lot of dispute about that. Next one up, which is the big one, is whether we want to, you know, grapple with the big one, which is licensure. Now, to get licensure passed in every state is a huge, huge obstacle financially, legally, and politically. It could take 10 years, $2 to $3 million, and God knows what else. And it's a big deal. But I think, personally, a kind of licensure, which you call it a title act, it's not a scope of practice bill, it's a title act which gives you the right to call yourself, for example, a homeopathic doctor. You do 4 years in a medical school homeopathic program, and the program could be very evolutionary. You know, it doesn't have to be a straight medical school. It could be teaching all sorts of stuff. It could be really broad. It could be a renaissance school. We could redefine medical education, you know, because we could train people in everything, you know, not just straight homeopathy. naturopathy, but to become a holistic physician, you know, it could be very broad. Then you come out and you can call yourself a homeopathic doctor. That would not in any way make it illegal for anyone else to practice homeopathy. They can do it freely under the health freedom regulation, but you just can't call yourself a homeopathic doctor. And I think that could give a level of recognition, because then you could get 4-year full-time homeopathic schools and attract a new level of professional to come into the profession. And I think that's what we have to grapple with.
Mm-hmm. Richard, before I switch it over to the audience, anything that you're working on, any projects that you want to tell people about, the journal that you publish, just anything that you want to share?
Yeah, so I'm co-editor of the California Homeopath. This is a biannual journal sponsored through the California Homeopathic Medical Society. I'm on the board of that medical society, and I've been trying to help that society kind of re-galvanize itself. It's one of the oldest societies in the United States. It began in 1880. And the California Journal was published in 1882, but till 1892 by William Borrecke, and then it morphed into the Pacific Coast Journal of Homeopathy. And me and Premananda Childs, a homeopath in Ojai, decided to revive it. And we have produced 4 editions of that journal. And you can get them by subscription. You can just call me, email me, and I will send you the forms. We're going to have an online version of it. I wanted to bring in
my contact information, Richard. How do they contact you?
So anyway, my phone number 415-695-8200, or just go to richardpitt.com.
Great.
And you can just access my information and go from there. But
and there's also information on there about your tobacco book and other things that you're
I wrote a book on tobacco. It's a proving of tobacco, but I wanted to do a broader study of it. So I'm doing that and that book there. But the journal I'm psyched about, I want to bring some more intellectual investigation in homeopathy. And people said, do we need another journal? But yeah, we got the American Homeopath once a year. We got Similimum twice a year. We've got the AIJH, the American Journal of Homeopathic Medicine, AJM, which is twice a year. I mean, and that's it for the whole United States. Let's do it. But I
agree with you, Richard. And personally, I think it's an excellent journal that you're doing. So
great.
I want to compliment you on it. And also the tobacco book, which for people who are not familiar with that book, I did interview Richard previously, and that is posted up on our website at wholehealthnow.com. So if you'd like to find out more about the book that he published on tobacco, it's well worth listening to that call.
You get a free cigarette with every purchase. So.
And you come over to their house and smoke it with them, right?
Yeah, I do. And my other two projects, I'm working on a materia medica book, a clinical relationship book right now, and I'm working on a philosophy book, Essays on Homeopathic Thought, which is just a collection of essays that I'm currently working on.
That's great. Well, maybe we can have you back to discuss those future works at a later time.
Great. Thank you.
Richard, thank you so much. I'm going to pass you on and let some other people ask questions, but I just want to personally thank you for your real wonderful passion for homeopathy. I find it very infectious and inspiring, so thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim.
Hold on a second. People, anybody would like to ask Richard Pitt a question?
I'd like to say something that I think one of the reasons that went apart from the, you know, having a hard time making money, one of the reasons that people aren't coming into the profession is because it is illegal in so many states.
Yeah.
And I was involved in Maryland. We're trying to get a health freedom bill through.
Yeah.
And we did not succeed last week.
Oh, dear.
But it's the first go-around, so I don't know how it's going to, you know, pan out over time.
Yeah.
But my personal opinion is that one needs to just educate.
Yeah.
One needs to educate legislatures, and that really is the first place to start.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think we've got to grapple with it, and we haven't wanted to, because I don't think we've had the feeling of the integration of ourselves. Our own identity hasn't been so clearly defined, so we've been reluctant as a profession to go forward in that way, you know? Because we haven't really wanted to be honest. Otherwise, I suppose we would have done. But I agree with you, the health freedom legislation, the great thing about that in California, not to mention Minnesota, which, you know, forged the way, is that within our profession, it helped recognize us and our validity. And for those of us who've practiced without a medical license, you know, all our lives, you know, in this country, for many years, for example, the NCH felt they couldn't even recognize us because their legal opinion they were getting was like, you don't want to identify them because you're taking a risk. But now we can say we are legitimate, we are legal, you know, and we have to have that.
Great.
There is an organization on the internet, Homeopathy Worldwide, that's been set up, and it's an effort to bring together all the leading homeopathic organizations, thinkers, scientists, practitioners, companies to one platform. Then they can go back to their different countries and they can say, you know, this worked in this country, this worked in that country, and build up the whole aspect of homeopathy worldwide.
Where did you say we could access that information? Could you give us, is there a URL?
homeopathyworldwide.org.
Thank you.
That's great.
Any other questions for Richard Pitt?
No, I really enjoyed what he was saying, no.
Any other questions?
Yes, I have one. This is Patricia Kay from Olympia, Washington. And I'm wondering, how did the acupuncturists do this? Don't they have like a national licensure, or is that a state-by-state thing?
State-by-state. They've got about 43 states that are licensed now. So most states are licensed, and they have a national board, but the state boards tend to be the more imposing exams to pass and tend to be the ones that people have to pass in order to practice legally in that state. So the national board just gives them the right to go into different states. But basically, they did it by hook and by crook. I mean, in California, they did it because there was a strong Chinese community always, especially in the Bay Area, and a lot of Chinese practitioners were practicing illegally, and some were being busted, and a lot of the things just came together. Jerry Brown was governor at that time, and it had a very progressive mandate and very progressive culture, and they did what the other lady was saying. They went out and camped out in Sacramento and got to know people. And I think what they had backing them up was like, well, they had 3,000 years of Chinese culture. A medical professional that was so alien in a sense to conventional medicine here that it seemed so different. So it had a certain authenticity based on its process. And also when they saw them putting needles in, it's a very physical process, even if they're working in sort of areas of esotericism similar to homeopathy when we're looking at qi and vital force. So I think they were able just to have a very you know, they could sell it more easily than we could sell homeopathy. So,
yeah, I think we have time for just one more question, so I'm going to unmute the line. Somebody have a final question for Richard Pitt?
Hi, Richard. This is Anna calling from Australia.
Hi, Anna.
Hi. So, I suppose whatever state one is going to practice in the United States, they just have to take it upon themselves to do this health freedom legislation. I don't even know what that entails or where would I start.
Well, you would basically try and find an alliance of people are within that state, and then you need to kind of like look at what's already been passed. You know, you could talk to me or John Melnichuk, who in California was the main person getting the California bill together. Diane Miller, who's in Minnesota, who's the chair of the National Health Freedom Coalition. And there's a lot of legal advice that you could get about actually what kind of law could work in your state, because every state has a different dynamic, and you need to just have the research to know what kind of thing could work there. Many of the bills, the Minnesota is slightly different than our bill, but between the two bills, basically that information is there to be used, and you need to just replicate the bill and then work and create the alliances with the other alternative and complementary practices in that state and create that alliance and then go forward, you know, get the funding, you need the funding, you have to have a good lobbyist and a good lawyer and move it forward, you know. So it just requires some research, but some of the access to that research exists here already. We can help you wherever you are. And again, I mentioned Diane Miller, you know, because she's, you know, that's her job, you know. So where are you thinking of going to? And I forgot.
Well, we'll initially go back to Michigan, and then after that, it could be anywhere. I think in the West, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Michigan's not easy. As far as I've heard, the way the legislature works is that they've been fairly strict in that way. It's easier out west, as you know, California's west, but Oregon and Washington are not easy. Washington is really bad right now. They're really going for alternative practitioners. There's a big campaign against them. There's a number of serious criminal cases now right now against alternative practitioners in Washington state.
Which I understand that there's even one of our well-known teachers and practitioners who's basically decided to stop going to Washington because of the situation there. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, Richard, well, this was an excellent call. I really appreciate, again, you taking the time out to join us and share all of your wisdom and experience. I'm going to unmute the lines to let everyone thank you personally, and thanks again, Richard. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.